Alex is going to talk about deleterious mutations as an evolutionary force.
That's correct. Okay, so since the audience is as mixed as ever, at least half of what I will be saying will be not interesting to at least half of the people, for which I have to apologize from the very beginning. But I think I must start from a very brief introduction of spontaneous mutation as a concept. I think that everybody knows what mutation is, but still I want to make explicit the difference between damage and mutation. So DNA can be damaged in the sense that its physical integrity is violated, and it can be done in hundreds of possible ways. You can have covalent crosslinks between DNA strands. You can have a breakage in the backbone of one strand or both strands. You can have thymine dimers or whatever. You can have individual nucleotides detached. All the things are called DNA damages. On the other hand, you can have a mutation, and the mutant DNA sequence is as good. The mutant DNA is as good as the initial DNA, as a generic DNA, but it has an altered nucleotide sequence. And I'm sure everybody knows it. DNA is a double helix with two anti-parallel strands. So you have some sequence before mutation and after mutation, if mutation is nucleotide substitution, for example. It's a substitution of a Watson-Crick pair TA into, say, pair AT. So that's what we had before, and then we have A here and T here. That's perfect DNA sequence in terms of the general organization, but the perfect DNA molecular, but the sequence is altered. Exactly. If you irradiate DNA, there will be no mutations. There will be only damages. Because... Yes, of course. So then there are two sources of mutation, of spontaneous mutation. It's errors in replication and errors in repair. We still don't know which mechanism for introducing spontaneous mutations is more important, and I suspect that the answer may be different for different cases. But we do know that both errors in DNA replication and errors in repair of DNA damages lead to mutation. For DNA replication, I only want to make one remark, which sometimes people don't know. So, as a kind of a caricature, replication happens this way. We have a double-stranded DNA, then two strands are separated, and then the complementary strand is built for each one. As a result, we have a semi-conservative DNA replication for we have two new molecules, and each new molecule contains one old strand and one new strand. That's, in this sense, the process is semi-conservative. The key point which I want to make here is this. DNA polymerase, the enzyme, DNA-dependent DNA polymerase, the enzyme which is doing DNA replication, has two active centers. In bacteria, it's on the same protein. In eukaryotes, I believe these are different proteins, but still they work together. One is a polymerase center, so it attaches a new nucleotide, which must be complementary to the old nucleotide. So we have this replication fork, and here this enzyme works. For example, we had A in the original strand, so it must attach nucleotide T. So one polymerase center attaches this T, and immediately the next center, which is called proofreading center, tries to remove this T, to pull it out. Why? Because if something erroneous was attached here, this erroneous nucleotide would be removed with very high probability. But since these molecular processes cannot work perfectly, even a correctly attached nucleotide can be removed in this struggle for fidelity. And according to some estimates, about 30% of correctly attached nucleotides are nevertheless removed. So if you try to increase DNA fidelity a little bit further, it will not work, you will remove everything. Very roughly, we will talk about exact numbers later, but very roughly, the probability that a wrong nucleotide will be attached in the first place is around 10⁻⁴, or maybe 10⁻⁵. And then, with probability which is another 10⁻⁴ or 10⁻⁵, this proofreading activity will fail to remove a wrong nucleotide. So first, in order for mutation to happen as a result of error in DNA replication, first a bad nucleotide must be attached, and then it must be not removed. And the probability of this is something around -8 or 10⁻⁸ or -10 tenths per nucleotide per replication. What is more interesting is that even after replication, very often, suppose that something escaped these two control stages and you have a bad nucleotide G. So you have a mismatched pair, you have a DNA which has actually DNA damage. You have a mismatch, AG. You have an AG pair, which is not a Watson-Crick pair. Again, I apologize to biologists who learned all this in intrabio, but physicists are not required to take intrabio, so I keep going. I will be done with this soon. This non-Watson-Crick pair AG is essentially DNA damage, and then two things may happen. This bad DNA may remain in this bad shape for a while, then it will replicate again, and for A we will get a complementary pair T, so we'll get a normal sequence, and another sequence will become mutated, we'll get a GC pair. So we will get a mutation, a real complete mutation. Or it may be that before the next round of replication, an enzyme which inspects the DNA will come here and we will see that something is wrong. And then it can either remove G and restore the normal sequence, or it can remove A and make the complete mutation immediately, not waiting for a replication. The point which I wanted to make is that for reasons which we partially understand and partially don't understand, very often the cell knows which strand is old and which strand is new. So if an enzyme finds such a situation, it knows that this A is a good A, but this G is a bad G. So this G will be replaced with T and not vice versa. So the take-home message is that cell struggles like crazy to have as few mutations as possible. And it is not difficult to prove that if you want the fidelity of replication process to approach infinity, or the error rate to approach zero, then the cost of replication in terms of both energy and time will approach infinity. So mutation rate cannot be zero. And a very interesting question, which I will consider later, but I want to announce it right now. The very interesting question is whether mutation rates which we have in nature are minimal or optimal. So let's make a thought experiment. Suppose that we change the laws of thermodynamics, and now it is possible to do perfect replication without paying a high cost. So under these circumstances, would mutation rate evolve to zero or not? If it would evolve to zero, then we say that mutation rates which we observe in nature are minimal, and their further reduction is prevented by cost of fidelity. If, even without a cost of fidelity, evolution will lead to some non-zero rate, then we'll say that we have some optimal mutation rate. We still don't know the answer. I strongly believe that mutation rates are minimal. So the only way, the only reason why we still have some mutation, and therefore why we have all the wonderful adaptive evolution. Well, optimal means that there are some beneficial mutations. And we do know that some beneficial mutations happen, but I believe that deleterious mutations so greatly outnumber beneficial mutations that on the balance, natural selection would try, would make mutation rate zero, if this is possible. And then evolution would stop. Yes. So if this is true, the only reason why evolution happens is that natural selection cannot get its way and cannot eliminate mutations whatsoever, altogether.
I vaguely remember an experiment where Drosophila was that the lab population was put into a mutagenic environment for several generations.
That's incredibly interesting.
After that, mutation rates had gone down.
I think there are only two people in the world who know this work. It's you and me. It's a paper by Nothill published in PNS in 1987. It was a horrible experiment, lasted for 500 generations. I'm not surprised nobody repeated it. Let's talk about this later. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you definitely can reduce mutation rate a little bit, but the question is whether you're paying any significant price for it. Okay. So, errors in DNA replication and also errors in DNA repair, any DNA damage, for example, just you have these nucleotides here and then one strand is broken. This damage must be repaired, and in the process of this repair, usually a lot of DNA is first destroyed and then resynthesized, and you can do it in the wrong way and make a mistake which will eventually become a mutation. Okay, so this was my first point. The only other thing about general nature of spontaneous mutation, sometimes, even these days, people erroneously think that radiation is an important source of spontaneous mutation. This is wrong. The normal level of radiation is responsible for less than 1% of spontaneous mutation. So spontaneous mutation process is truly spontaneous in the sense that it's not caused by any external influence. But well, I think, if anything, we should be wondering why mutations are so rare, because in each human cell, the total length of a DNA is over 1 meter, and you have to replicate this incredible polymer, essentially without any error, so I don't think we should wonder why spontaneous mutations do happen. Okay, then another equally trivial biological introduction. Mutations can be classified into substitutions when we replace one nucleotide with the other without changing the total length of DNA. If it's a replacement of a purin with a purin or pyrimidine with pyrimidine, it's called transition. If it's a replacement of a big thing, which is a purin with a small thing, which is a pyrimidine, or vice versa, it's called transversion. So substitutions are classified into transitions and transversions, or we have a deletion, can have a deletion, or we can have an insertion. If insertion sequence is identical to something around it, it's called duplication, and quite often we have what people call complex events, which really is just a general situation. So you have a DNA sequence with some subsequence 1, and after mutation you get sequence with some subsequence 2. And this is the most general mutation, obviously. Subsequence 1 can be, I don't know, ATC, and after mutation you have GG. About at least 5% of mutations, spontaneous mutations in humans, cannot be called substitutions or insertions or deletions. They're just this generic complex events. So all kinds of things can happen. All these things are loosely called point mutations or micromutations, where only one or few nucleotides are involved. But you also can have a big event when, I don't know, part of a chromosome are deleted, or 1,000 nucleotides are deleted, or a transposable element is inserted. So mutation can be of every scale, from replacement of a single nucleotide to big deletion or insertion or duplication. Okay, and finally, in terms of, you can classify mutations by how they affect phenotypes, and I will talk only about one kind of generic, the most inclusive phenotypic trait, which is fitness. And in terms of how a mutation affects fitness, we can talk about neutral mutations, beneficial or advantageous mutations, and deleterious mutations. I think these terms are self-explanatory. And beneficial mutations is a very big, interesting question. How many beneficial... We do know that a lot of mutations are deleterious. We do know that a lot of mutations are neutral or at least very nearly neutral. I think it's a good idea to distinguish two concepts of neutrality, which I would call populational neutrality and genomic neutrality. Populational neutrality and genomic. So, for mutation to be populationally neutral, and that's what Dr. Otto discussed in the morning, selection coefficient involved with this mutation must be below 1 over effective population size. If this is true, then natural selection is powerless to control this mutation. If it is good, it will not help it. If it is bad, it will not work against it. Genomic neutrality happens when selection coefficient is less than 1 over G, which is the genome size in nucleotides, which means that even if you make such mutations for all nucleotides in the genome, still the total impact on fitness will be not very large. And these are two different concepts of neutrality, but in population biology, much more attention was attracted to this populational neutrality, but I think genomic neutrality is also a useful concept.
So what was the one
over G? G is the genome size in nucleotides.
Genome
size in nucleotides. So I have 3 billion nucleotides in my genome. So if I have a mutation with selection coefficient 1 over million, it may be populationally neutral because human effective population size is only about 10,000. But if you have billion mutations with selection coefficient 1 over millions, the cumulative damage is 1,000, right? 10 to the minus 6 times. So this populationally neutral thing is not genomically neutral. And what does it mean? We really don't know.
How did you get the effect of size?
You mean how it was measured?
Yeah.
It is a long-term size. Currently, it's obviously much bigger, but if you study genetic variability within a human population, which we have today, which mostly reflects old history, this genetic variability is so low that you can estimate the size of the human lineage during the last million years, and different estimates vary between 10 to the 4th and 10 to the 5th, but no more than that.
So it's basically the human population about a million years ago, or
Yes. And again, this is not an actual size; that's an effective size. So even not the, apparently there were no real bottlenecks. There was no Adam and Eve. When I was teaching evolutionary biology, I had to confront the Roman Catholic chaplain of Cornell University and explain to this poor guy that his you know, the Catholic Church is very proud that they recently said that evolution probably did happen, but they still haven't... No, I'm not kidding. That's exactly how it happened. I can go into this detail because I had to deal with it. There are a lot of Roman Catholics at Cornell University. But they still have an encyclical standing which says that if you don't believe in Adam and Eve, you are out of the Church. And, well... Pardon me? Yes, 10 to the 5 of them is no good. You need only one, because otherwise how the original sin will spread. And I had a very interesting theological discussion with this guy, which I won on all points, I believe. So there were no big bottlenecks, but still the effective size can be way smaller than the actual size. Suppose you have a village, then the neighbors come and eat everybody who live in this village. And they will, which happens all the time. And these poor villagers will not contribute their genes. So roughly speaking, the effective size is the number of individuals which lived simultaneously, which all contributed genes to the current human diversity. Very roughly speaking. Okay, so we have neutral mutations with very small selection coefficients. You cannot have exact neutrality. You will have may have selection coefficient 10 to the minus 23rd, but nothing is exactly zero. But for all practical purposes, 10 to the minus 23rd selection is exactly zero. Then we have beneficial mutations and deleterious mutations. I will ignore beneficial mutations for the rest of my talk today, which may not be a good idea, because we do know that significantly beneficial mutations are very rare. These days there is a resurgence of interest in beneficial mutations, because after all, evolution happens due to fixation of beneficial mutations. And in particular, a guy named Chen Yiwu, who works in the University of Chicago, is kind of promoting the idea that beneficial mutations are quite common, but even his estimate is that you have maybe only one in the human lineage, there was maybe only one beneficial replacement per 1,000 generations. So, beneficial mutations with large effects are obviously rare, which is not surprising because we are results of very long evolution, and to improve us further is very difficult. But mildly beneficial mutations might be very common, because what we heard this morning about near neutrality means that a lot of nucleotide sites may be occupied by slightly suboptimal nucleotides. And when you replace this slightly bad, slightly deleterious nucleotide with the correct one, then you get a mildly beneficial mutation. But let's ignore them altogether. Let's talk about mutations with significant selection coefficients, and then we have neutral mutations and deleterious mutations. Nobody really knows in what proportions. Okay, now I think what I want to do, I will consider two situations. It's really one model and several possible implications of this model, which illustrates why the deleterious mutation process may be important. I have to tell in advance that up to this day we don't know whether what I'm going to tell you is biologically relevant or not, which is unfortunate but true. So it's not necessary to argue that beneficial mutations are important. All Darwinian evolution, after we learned that genes exist, we understand that Darwinian evolution consists of accumulation of beneficial mutations. And we originated from bacteria due to accumulation of a lot of beneficial mutations. but why deleterious mutations are important for anything, that's a not such a trivial question. Let's attempt to ask it. So I will assume very approximately that all deleterious alleles which we have are equally bad. So I can describe a genotype just by the total number of bad alleles. Of course, that's an approximation, but that's enough in order to make an argument. And this is fitness. So let's assume that we have a strict truncation. You have less than some critical number k of bad alleles and you are okay. You have k or more bad alleles and you are dead. What's going to happen in this case if we consider two opposite extremes, obligate sex and obligate asex? Let's start from obligately asexual population under this truncation selection. What would be the equilibrium distribution of the number of bad alleles per individual? Who can guess? Yes, of course. They will all have this critical, or if critical is not allowed, that critical number minus one number of mutations. And now, asex. Now I will have to introduce the key variable big U. I recently published a comment in Trends in Genetics, which was titled Sex and You, and they told me that their subscription doubled immediately. So that's a very good notation. So big U is a genomic rate of deleterious mutations. So under this sum value of big U, what will be the mean thickness of a sexual asexual population? The answer is geared to the minus U. Since mutations arrive independently, we have a Poisson distribution of the number of de novo mutations in the genome, and at this equilibrium, an offspring survives only if it didn't receive even one de novo mutation, and the probability of this is e up to the minus u. So if we talk in terms of genetic load, which is...
U is the mutation rate?
Yes, per genome. The expected number of mutations per genome. So e up to the minus u is the probability that you don't get even one mutation.
Right.
So if we talk in terms of genetic load, which is the decrement of mean fitness relative to the maximal fitness, the genetic load is one minus e up to the minus u in case of asexual reproduction. On the other hand, if we have a sexual population, this situation will never happen, because even if you artificially choose only those sexuals which have, you know, exactly 100 bad mutations, they will interbreed, and next moment you will have some reasonable distribution. It will not be exactly independent, because you don't destroy all linkage to the equilibria in one generation, but the variance will be pretty big. So in this case, the genetic load can be very small. There is a funny theorem that for a given genomic deleterious mutation rate, under this truncation selection, you can make genetic load arbitrarily small. If you increase this critical number of mutations, then you cut a very small fraction of individuals, and you restore the same number of mutations. Well, let me go into this for a second, because for physicists this should be... Well, you probably already understand me, but anyway. So what does it take to have a mutation selection balance? You need selection differential, another horrible term, to be equal to minus mutation rate. Selection differential is a term introduced by Fisher. I'm not responsible for this. And this is mean number of, mean number of mutations after selection, minus mean number of mutations before selection. And if you cut, say, 50% of your distribution, then then the selection differential will be, assuming Gaussian distribution, something like 0.8 times standard deviation of this distribution. Standard deviation of the distribution of number of mutations per genotype. So the point is this: when you increase the standard deviation, you can make the absolute impact of cutting a very small number of very small fraction of the population, you can make the absolute impact as big as you want. And well, that's basically the whole idea. So if this critical number and this standard deviation is very roughly of the order of square root from the critical number, because the variance very roughly is equal to the mean, and the mean is around critical number, so the standard deviation is about square root from the critical number. So you make the critical number of mutations very big, and under given genomic deleterious mutation rate, you get a mutation load with sex very small, as small as you want. In contrast with asex, as you can see, the mutation load does not depend on this critical number at all. It depends only on genomic deleterious mutation rate. So that's one reason deleterious mutations can be important. They can provide the advantage of sex. And this advantage of sex requires two conditions, which were implicit in everything which I said. First of all, remember, advantage of sex means that genetic load without sex is big. And genetic load without sex is 1 up to the 1 minus e up to the minus u. So this thing is substantial only if u is big enough. So we want u to be of the order of 1, of the order of 1 at least. Well, it can be 0.8, but it cannot be 0.1. Something like this. So that's the first condition. In order for deleterious mutations to provide substantial advantage to sex, genomic deleterious mutation rate should be of the order of 1. And this is condition A. And condition B is that we must have appropriate selection. I assume this strict truncation below critical number fitness 1, above critical number fitness 0. You don't need a strict truncation, but you need selection which has what we call synergistic epistasis. So if this is number of bad mutations and this is fitness, synergistic epistasis means that the addition into the genotype of each next bad mutation leads to a larger decline of relative fitness. So formally speaking, this means that the second derivative of a logarithm of fitness must be negative. If this is true everywhere, we have synergistic epistasis, and in this case, genetic load under sex is smaller than genetic load under asex. It may be an interesting footnote, again for mathematically inclined people, interesting footnote why it happens. It happens due to the following reason. If we have this kind of selection with synergistic epistasis defined this way, then when this selection acts on the population, it reduces the variance. This was actually proven by... Yes, yes. Let me finish this formal stuff. First of all, haploids and asexuals are not synonyms. You can have sexual haploids and asexual diploids. Let me finish this formal stuff, and then we'll talk about reality. So, if we have selection which obeys this rule, if we apply it to Gaussian distribution, which corresponds to independent occurrence of different mutations, after selection the variance will be less than before selection. And therefore, and sex only restores the variance. So if selection reduces the variance, then sex is good because it restores it and makes selection more efficient. On the other hand, if we have selection with the opposite side of the epistasis, sex is actually bad. So if we have this selection with negative epistasis, and truncation is the extreme case of this, and if we have genomic deleterious mutation rate of the order of 1 or higher, then sexual reproduction can be beneficial because it allows a better removal of deleterious mutations. All this argument was done in terms of group selection, really. We compared how sexuals as a group competes with asexuals as a group, which in this case is acceptable because asexuals form a group. There is no distinction between group selection and individual selection as long as obligate asexuals are involved. But we also can think of how deleterious mutations affect evolution within a sexual population, which requires a little bit more complicated approach. That's a so-called modifier gene approach. So suppose that I have many mutable loci where deleterious mutations can happen, and I also have, say, one locus which controls, for example, rate of recombination. One locus with genotypes R and, well, alleles R and R prime, then I can calculate what will be distributions of the number of bad mutations in subpopulations which correspond to genotypes R and R prime. And if I assume that these two genotypes have similar properties, I get very nice singularly perturbed system with a fast component which correspond to mutation selection equilibrium, and the slow component which corresponds to slow changes in the frequency of these alleles R and R prime. And there is some mathematical theory of this, so we can ask similar questions again about evolution on the background of strong selection against deleterious mutations. We can ask these questions in the context of individual selection, and we can find equilibrium, or more precisely quasi-equilibrium, differences in the mean and variance of the number of bad mutations for different modifier alleles, and then see how selection acts on these modifier alleles. And the results of this analysis shows that selection against deleterious mutations can induce a lot of fascinating processes within sexual populations. For example, it can be responsible for evolution of recombination. So even if you have sexual population, suppose that you have recombination due to independent assortment of different chromosomes, you have it automatically, but then there is a mysterious and beautiful process called crossing over. And why the hell do you need crossing over? Nobody knows. Sometimes people say that crossing over exists because it is necessary for meiosis, which is just plain stupid, because Drosophila males and heterogametic sex in about 30 different taxa, they lost crossing over entirely, and they are doing meiosis perfectly well. So if Drosophila males or butterfly females can do it, why not everybody else? Let's see very roughly what happens in terms of individual selection. So suppose that this is a very rough illustration, but I think it gives you some idea how individual selection is different from group selection here. So again, this is number of bad mutations. This is a distribution of mutations. And let's return for simplicity to this situation of truncation selection. So let's assume that this variance is a little bit below linkage equilibrium variance. So if you introduce more recombination, for example, due to crossing over, the variance of this distribution will grow. The mean, of course, remains the same, because a recombination is a fair process. It doesn't add mutations and doesn't remove mutations per se. So the question is whether this increase of the variance will be instantly beneficial or instantly deleterious. And the answer is obvious. If you kill more than 50% of a population, this tail which you keep will be larger if the variance is larger. If you kill only these things, then the smaller the variance, the larger your fitness. So recombination is good in terms of this short-term gain which governs individual selection if genetic load is larger than 50%. The actual threshold is a little bit lower due to some second-order effect, but it gives you some good idea. So that's a pretty striking conclusion. In order to explain crossing over through as a consequence, as an evolutionary consequence of selection against bad mutations. In order to do this, we have to assume that 50% of the offspring are killed due to selection against deleterious mutations. Looks like a every generation. Looks like a bizarre assumption, but first of all, this might be true, and second, all other explanations of why crossing over make sense.
Well, what's that word, crossing over?
Crossing over. Crossing over. This means that you have to... Do I need to explain?
No, I just...
The
pronunciation.
Okay.
Explain it anyway.
Okay. So you have two chromosomes, that's a centromere. And that's a diploid, either a diploid organism or a diploid stage of a sexual life cycle anyway. And they can either be transmitted as they are to the offspring. After meiosis, this chromosome will go into one gamete and this will go into the other gamete. Or they can exchange their homologous parts. And this process of exchange of homologous parts, which requires a lot of interesting DNA mechanisms, which I completely ignore, this process is called crossing over. And it leads to additional recombination of genetic material on top of recombination, which is provided by independent assortment of different chromosomes. Okay? So, in order for individual selection to favor crossing over, we need to kill 50% of offspring every generation due to selection, not due to any random factors. And the only reason why I take this crazy possibility seriously is that other attempts to explain crossing over are even more bizarre. Because think of it, if you are old enough to reproduce, your genotype must be good. And the most stupid thing which you want to do is to reshuffle your good combination of genes and, you know, well, do this risky game of trying something totally different. So, in order for this to make sense, the life must be such that what is good now is not going to be good next generation. So you have to constantly do this reshuffling. I'm not going to consider the topic of the evolution of sex in general, because there are a lot of hypotheses, most of them completely crazy, and some of them barely passable, like this one. But I ask you to take my word that selection against deleterious mutations is an underlying factor responsible for the benefit of sex and for benefit of crossing over within sexual population and for some other things. Selection against deleterious mutations is as reasonable an explanation as any other. Which doesn't mean that this explanation is correct. Probably I should mention explicitly at least one competent explanation. The competent possibility is selection for beneficial mutations. Suppose that the environment changes like crazy, either in irreversible way or it fluctuates widely, and then I have a good combination of genes, but next generation this combination of genes will be pretty lousy, so I have to do crossing over. And in terms of genetic load, the conditions for when crossing over is good under this beneficial mutations change in environment scenario, the threshold is pretty much the same.
What's special about the 50 creatures that don't do crossing over?
There is nobody who is not doing crossing over in both sexes. There are a lot of cases where heterogametic sex loses crossing over, nobody knows why, but in the homogametic sex, crossing over is always there. There is not a single example of a complete loss of crossing over in a sexual form. At least I'm not aware of this. Usually it's one event per chromosome. Sometimes a little bit higher. I think garden peas, which Mendel used, per generation, yes. Garden peas is hold the record. It's about five events, five crossovers.
But isn't Genesis close to the
second? Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to go into this. We will cross an hour. You can have a two-semester course and cross an hour to see. But my only point is that sexual reproduction and cross an hour as a part of it is a very strange thing, which probably indicates that some very rapid process, very short-term acting process constantly makes what is good today makes it suboptimal tomorrow. And this could be either because the genotype per se gets corrupted by mutations, or because the environment changes. Personally, I don't like these environmental explanations at all, because if we have these widely fluctuating environments, we can expect that population which traces this widely fluctuating environment would also widely fluctuate. So you see big elephants, and 10 generations later there will be small elephants, and that's how populations will live, and we don't observe anything like this. But of course, people who like this change in environment hypothesis, they're not stupid. They say, yeah, it's not your body size, it may be your genes which are necessary to combat parasites or something which is not easily visible on the surface. And the answer is, who knows? So,
there's like an example of insects where they may have more than one cycle per year, so one is in the spring, one in the fall. Conditions are quite different, so their allele frequencies actually change sinusoidally as they go through.
Yes, this happens occasionally, but sex is an extremely generic phenomenon. It happens everywhere in eukaryotes with very few exceptions, including things which live under environments which for us look very stable, I don't know, deep sea bottoms. And what is good about deleterious mutations is that at least potentially it is a very generic phenomenon. Nobody doubts that deleterious mutations happen everywhere.
Also, could one also add that if it were to do with parasites, then it's not so easy to see why it should affect the whole genome. You would then perhaps expect that certain areas of the genome would have a lot of different.
Who knows? Okay, I am not going to badmouth this beneficial mutation fluctuating environment hypothesis. It's still not officially dead. I only want to say that despite all the craziness of assumptions of deleterious mutation-based explanation, all other explanations are at least equally crazy. And which one is correct, we don't know.
I would like to understand more precisely this statement about how do you actually mean that one has to observe physically, or it's only potentially that they might have died if they would have been...
No, we're not observing anything. That's a model. The only question which I'm asking is this. You have two distributions with equal means, and one variance is larger and another is smaller. And then you truncate, kill some fraction. In which case, increase of the variance will lead to the increase of the fraction which survives. And the answer is that if you truncate more than 50%. Yes, of course. When I mean, of course.
Preference it can take care of.
Yes. This may be sexual preference. That's absolutely right. If you have a polygamous species, especially birds which reproduce on legs, there can be one big, I don't know, turkey which inseminates absolutely everything around, and there are other 50 turkey which look equally good, which don't obtain any mating, because when they try to mate, this big thing will give them hard time. So physical death is not necessary.
No.
If you have close relatives interbreeding, then partially deleterious mutations become homozygous. Fitness immediately plunges due to a phenomenon called inbreeding depression. So interbreeding of close relatives is absolutely not equivalent to asexual reproduction. That's an entirely different thing. And again, that's another thing which I don't want to touch, but okay, very briefly, you can have all kinds of mating systems in populations, from extreme outcrossing, when there are these self-incompatibility systems preventing matings between close relatives, to almost obligatory self-fertilization. And again, using selection against deleterious mutations as a kind of evolutionary fuel, you can explain evolution of different mating systems under different circumstances. I just don't want to go into this detail because I hope that I was already able to convince you that deleterious mutations may be very important as a kind of a positive evolutionary force responsible for adaptation such as sex and recombination. I don't want to talk about this in detail because all these things are old news. They are at least, I don't know, around 10 years old. And this understanding was, well, certainly here around 1990, and then it became obvious that we need to check these two conditions, epistatic selection and whether genomic deleterious mutation rate is of the order of 1 or not. And actually this condition is more important, because if big U is larger than 1, selection is bound to be epistatic. If it is not epistatic, then we will all be dead. I forget to mention that if we have selection without epistasis, so thickness declines exponentially with the number of bad mutations, then genetic load with sex is exactly equal to genetic load without sex. So under exponential selection, zero epistasis, second derivative of logarithm is zero, load sexual equals to load asexual equals to 1 minus a up to the minus u. The only difference is that for asexuals, this is independent on the mode of selection, and for sexual reproduction, if we have synergistic epistasis, the load is smaller, and if we have another epistasis, the load is actually bigger.
Just within the formal version of your model, if you have twice the rate of recombination in one sex and none in the other, do things come out the same?
Well, all this assumes free recombination.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. You said there's 50 cases where one sex has recombination in meiosis and other, but most of us creatures have equal or approximate recombination in both sexes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying if you have twice as much recombination in the meiosis of, say, the females and none in the male, is all the formalism the same?
Well, the formalism is approximately the same. Okay, so that's what we have for genetic load. Therefore, if genomic deleterious mutation rate is really high, this epistasis, this shape of fitness curve, must be here. And on the other hand, measuring this shape experimentally is extremely difficult. I think this is a kind of a paradigm of a hopeless experimental task, because you cannot measure the second derivative of a logarithm of a function if neither x nor y can be measured. So how many deleterious mutations do I carry? I have no idea. How big is my fitness? Okay, you can measure the number of my children, but this is fitness under lousy conditions. What would be my fitness under real conditions? I don't know, probably zero, but maybe not that bad. So there are some attempts to measure epistasis. There are some brave people who are trying to do this, and when I have to review these papers, I even write positive reviews just to reward them for their bravery, but personally I believe it's all nonsense. So I believe that the only thing which is more or less measurable here is the genomic deleterious mutation rate. And now, again, everything which was said before is kind of old news, and now I'm going to talk about new news, because measuring genomic deleterious mutation rate, or at least talking about it, became very fashionable later. And yeah?
Mm-hmm. You said that the exponential case is the borderline different sex or asex.
Mm-hmm.
Exponential is very generic if you have multiplicativity.
Of course.
So
if selection affects
it. It's difficult to measure fitness curve which goes above
expansion,
which would go below.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Nobody seriously thinks that you have something like this. So it's either independent removal of mutation or something more truncation like. At least that's what everybody says. Whether this is true, it's another question, yeah.
One question regarding sex specific mutation rates. If in the mouse, for example, the main mutation of the six times as high as in the
first of all, nobody knows this. It's
suppose
that's true.
Suppose this was true. Then it would would seem a bit crazy for the female to shop the genes from the male where there are so many more mutations. Or is that
Well, mammals are kind of crazy. Mammals kind of... Okay, let's talk about simple things and the differences between sexes. This is really bad. Let's talk about simple things. Even simple things are going to be bad enough. So...
Wait, this is the first time I've heard of something like this. Is this generally true that mutation rate is gender dependent?
Yes, it's very easily can be so because in a male germline in mammals, from zygote to zygote, they have 300 cell divisions. In a female germline, they have only 30 cell divisions. Because in a woman, all her eggs are ready when she's minus four months old. Uh-huh. And men produce sperm all the life. So Dr. Crow teaches us that we need to conserve our sperm when we're 15 years old and then use it for reproduction during the whole life, which I think is reasonable genetically.
So mutation rates in males are always higher than in mammals?
Probably. It's, people thought that this is true until recently. Now some people challenge this, who knows. In Drosophila it seems that the number of cell divisions per male and female germline is the same, and then these cell division dependent mutations are mutations which occur during replication, but time, since we ignore relativistic effects, time goes with the same rate in males and females, so mutations due to errors in DNA repair may happen equally. So this is not true, but probably to some extent males have higher mutation rates than females, at least in mammals. Okay, so the story here is a paradigm of how evolutionary biology misfunctions, because this hypothesis became, well, the importance of measuring genomic deleterious mutation rate became obvious to some people, well, about quarter a century ago, and 10 years ago it was already common knowledge. Everybody knew this. And then you can expect a lot of young, ambitious experimentalists, you know, abandoning all stupid things which they are doing and starting measuring genomic deleterious mutation rates, and absolutely nothing like this happened. These young, ambitious experimentalists were doing stupid things and keep doing stupid things, and the same old theorists who invented these hypotheses, so it's a kind of a do-it-yourself attitude. You propose the hypothesis, you want to know whether this hypothesis is true, very well, go ahead and measure it. And I used to think that physics is a little bit smarter, but now I was told that physics is equally stupid, which gives me some comfort. So, still it's pretty. Sometimes it's very discouraging, and it's also counterproductive because it's very rarely when a decent theorist can also be a good fly pusher. And well. You know, you're laughing, but there were 3 months in my life when I pushed over a million Drosophila, and this is no fun. The first 100,000 is okay, but after this, it gets a little bit boring. I'm obviously not the best person to push Drosophila, but it's fun. Okay, so what do we know about mutation rates? So the rest, Michael, I can take a break, because if we're going to have any breaks, that's a good time now. Okay, so
short break,
and then we'll talk about experiment. About ugly and messy real life, or actually about our attempts to measure it quantitatively.
Yeah. At the end, when you're all through, I'm trying to figure out what it is you will hope to have proven to us, namely that deleterious mutations are very important for some kind of progressive.
Well, I wouldn't call it progressive, but sexual reproduction is here, and as we all know, explaining why it is here okay. may be fun.
That's your purpose, okay.
Well, yeah. I'm not going, well, this is my pet idea that sex is here because of deleterious mutations, but I'm not going to advocate it really. I'm perfectly happy to admit that we don't know whether this is true or not. Personally, I believe that this is true mostly because other competing explanations are even less plausible than deleterious mutations. But I understand that that's a lot of the argument, so I'm by no means I'm arguing that we know the answer. Let's come to this later. Let me talk about the data. Forget about evolution, no evolution, just... Well, I think so, but again, we don't really know this.
It's relatively easy to implement duplicative mechanism, not double-stranded, you make two double-stranded, which will just make it square or decreasing.
Well, first of all, this is impossible. If God wanted this, he would create a...
What about gene conversion? Isn't it if you
introduce additional stage of...
No. I think the statement is about not diploidy, but four strands of DNA.
Yeah. Two double-stranded.
Well, I have two double-stranded DNAs and you have two double-stranded DNA, but then what? It doesn't affect mutation rate.
It's a different mechanism, some mechanism.
Like in gene conversion, bring together almost identical molecules and make a consensus.
Okay.
That's what conversion does.
There are error correcting
codes. Well, yeah, but then there will be errors in this vote and rules or whatever hell.
Yeah, so you square it.
I don't know.
Okay. Relatively simple error correcting codes.
Well, it doesn't mean that these things can be implemented in...
You actually taught us about another technique of avoiding them, as you said, having the DNA, carrying it from the beginning, one can do the same for the men.
Well, for example, if you don't have enough male, and there is a... if you don't have enough sperm, and female mates with 25 males in one night, which our closest relative chimps routinely do, then you will not transfer any genes.
Can I ask a very naive physicist question?
Sure.
Because I'm struggling to understand what you're saying. You say your message is sex is here because of the deleterious mutation.
Well, that's one possibility.
Right. So if you come to me and make this statement, it sounds to me quite possible. It seems completely reasonable. So perhaps you can tell us why some people think that this is not reasonable.
Well, some people say that deleterious mutations are so rare that they are irrelevant to anything.
Oh, so it's a question of how big.
Yes, exactly. That's what I want to consider. That's big thing.
That's a quantitative, but that's an experimental question.
Yes, exactly. I want to talk about experiments, for Christ's sake, because theory goes to hell.
So physicists, let's say, go out and measure here.
Exactly, and I said it 20 years ago, and I was told, go and do it yourself.
I should add one thing first. Other explanations are not necessarily contradictory to this one. They are not mutually exclusive. So, Dr. Hamilton, for example, is right with this idea about the role of parasites, and this would not be harmful to this theory, but both could be like
this. Yeah, yeah.
And it was perhaps a bit overdone, this idea that one has to find out which of the two is right and which is wrong. Because
right. So this is in the physics culture. There's only one can be right.
Yeah. I think it's played this field a little bit too much. But nevertheless, one would want to know which is more important. I mean, even if both
can be right.
Well.
And another comment, because you asked the question, why, what is the message of all this, why was there such a problem to biologists? Until the early 70s, biologists thought that they understood why there is sex. And had to ask the question, they would have said, oh, well, very easy to explain. And then, in the 70s, the number of people, including John Maynard Smith, made a very annoying discovery that in simple models, if you assume that you have a mutant that switches from sexual reproduction to parthenogenesis, that this mutant would have a twofold advantage, would have twice the fitness
so that the subpopulation that does not do sex would have twice the growth rate of the sexual one, and that means that within a very short time it would have gained the government growth, so to speak. And from this moment on, it was a big problem what is able to overcome the twofold growth of sex, and this really is the best answer, I think, to this.
Might be the correct answer or not. What I want to observe is that when you were doing your talk, it was mainly Smith who started this business. The first model of sympatric speciation, I mean formal model of sympatric speciation, which I discussed yesterday, was proposed by Maynard Smith. And Maynard Smith is also responsible for all this, I mean, resurgence of interest to the evolution of sex, because he indeed showed by very simple argument that whatever is a factor responsible for maintenance of sex, this must be a strong short-term acting factor, which for some reason nobody understood before. And yes, there is this tendency to say that we don't need to really choose between different explanations, because and the 60% of sex is explainable by selection against deleterious mutations, and 40% is explainable by fluctuating environment and population accumulating beneficial mutations in order to keep up with the environment, and I really don't like it. And the reason I don't like this is the following. Let's draw the mutation rate on a logarithmic scale. So this is the logarithm of mutation rate. And if mutation rate is larger than 1, bad mutations explain sex alone. If it's below 0.3, bad mutations are totally irrelevant. And the same sharp transition happens with the rate of changes of the environment. If the rate is high enough, change in environment explains sex without any mutations. If the rate is 5 times slower, change in environment is completely irrelevant. So I can't believe that big U is larger than 1, or I can't believe that it is smaller than 1, but it's hard for me to believe it's exactly 0.45. So I don't like this pluralistic. I understand that some people are nice and say, guys, you don't want to fight, you can split it, and I don't like it.
Yeah, but I mean, I understand that in both cases you would want to know whether you are beyond the threshold, so that the arguments but it could be true in principle that explanations work.
Sure, but if they can both work, but only if each one would be sufficient even alone. Yeah, I'm not saying that environment doesn't change. Okay, let's talk about real world. So the story of measuring genomic deleterious mutation rate is nice because it's absolutely not finished, and one may be inclined to argue that it's barely started. So the first attempt to do this was done by Terumi Mukai. He did it in Japan in 1964. Then he moved to the States and redid the experiment and published it in Crow's lab in 1972. And in both cases, he observed this thing: genomic deleterious mutation rate of the order of 1 or higher. So what did he do? I will lie a little bit, and those who are familiar with Mukai work will forgive me, and those who are not familiar will not notice the lie anyway. So he used a certain Drosophila technique to shelter Drosophila genome from selection. Actually, it was only second chromosome. So this is generation. And this is fitness. So
from selection means just
he kept a chromosome against the balancer, and it was only one male which he chose for each line every generation. And then he took random offspring, so apparently there was no correlation between how good is the chromosome and whether you reproduce or not. So he tried to shut down selection, and for different Drosophila lines observed how fitness declines in the course of generations. Fitness without selection. Obviously, fitness is going to decline without selection because deleterious mutations are more common than advantageous mutations. The question is how rapidly. So, first of all, he measured the decline in the mean fitness, and second, you also, in order to recover the number of discrete events, you also need to measure the increase in the variance. Because imagine that this decline is due to infinitely many mutations with very small effects. Then they will all decline with exactly the same rate. On the other hand, if this decline is due to few mutations with large effects, somebody will be unlucky, will accumulate a lot of mutations, and other things will be lucky and maybe will not accumulate any mutations. So if you know both the rate of decline in the mean fitness and also the rate of increase in the variance between different lines, then you can, under some assumptions, recover the absolute number of bad mutations.
But can you really, if you remember the cause of this moment, this could be the effect of a single mutation can be a wide distribution.
Distribution of what?
In size, in deleterious.
Of course. We assume that all mutations are equally bad, and we can make some adjustments to this.
This can be very wrong.
Okay. You're right. There are more variables there than equations. Yeah, but even deleterious mutations still can have...
Even the worst ones, I mean...
Yes, even...
Your curve goes
continuously. Absolutely.
Excuse me, by taking your one male, its generation, it was doing exactly what I was... what you told me, it's not the same thing, like in breeding.
No, he crossed them with totally different females from a different population. And... it was one chromosome. I can do the whole genetic schemes, which will be this whole blackboard, and this is not going to be interesting. So, and you're absolutely right that you really have, I forget, four variables for only two equations, but under some assumptions you can make some minimal estimates. And his conclusion was that mutation rate is of the order of one, and in particular he observed that mean fitness declines by 2% per generation. So after, I don't know, 25 generations, fitness is only 50% of the initial fitness. So this is decline in the mean. Since even this is now disputed, I'm not going to talk about the variance. And in 1964, nobody paid serious attention except Crow, who invited Mukai. In 1972, on the other hand, everybody said this is great. And for a long period of time, this became kind of accepted, although not very many people were thinking about it. And then in 1994, my dear friend Pete Keithley from Edinburgh said that Mukai was damn wrong. And it's not these fine points about increasing the variance which Keithley challenged. He went right after the core. He said there was no decline in mean fitness. It was not Mukai experimental populations which deteriorated. It was his control which improved. And indeed, it is a big problem because this experiment takes generations, and although Drosophila multiplies very rapidly, still a generation is at the very least 11 days, so you have to keep these flies for a year, and they cannot live that long, so you have to keep a control population. And Mukai, I am ready to admit that his control was open to questions. So Keithley said it was improvement of his control, so even this decline in the mean was not real. Who cares about the virus? I don't care about the virus mutation rate. I care about something real. And real is at least a fly, better a human. But who cares about it? Okay, no. I'm not talking about... that's a good point, actually. I'm not talking about mutation rates and viruses, bacteria, and all this crap. Because to measure them is much simpler, and their mutation rate is well below one, for sure. For one generation of E. coli, mutation rate is well below one. I'm talking about multicellular organisms, yes?
But it's insufficient to measure the identity of the control, whatever control does.
No, if control improves due to natural selection, then you're measuring the efficiency of natural selection in control and not anything in experiment.
Fitness is just the number of offspring per individual?
Yes, and this depends on the conditions, of course. So Mukai used competitive fitness. He made these things to compete with control. Or it was even a little bit more complicated like this. It's a number of survived offspring under competitive conditions. If you keep a population, then a good gene can invade this population and take over, and the whole population will be better. It's extremely difficult to make sure that there is no Darwinian selection. And if you shut down Darwinian selection, then you get your experiment.
So the most interesting organism to use would be the simplest eukaryote in which recombination first arose, right? Because
this thing was lived 2 billion years ago.
Rather than why we have it. Because we have it because we inherited it from all sorts of simpler creatures which already had it, right? And so did the supplement.
Yes. Okay, with simple eukaryotes like yeast, you can try to do this, but there are other complications, because in yeast, sex is facultative. It happens only when conditions deteriorate. So, effectively, you have kind of a super generation. It's not one cell division, it's the number of cell divisions between episodes of declined fitness. How common these episodes are in nature, nobody knows. And the argument behind studying these things in Drosophila is this. We know that a lot of organisms can abandon sex if they want. For example, water fleas, Daphnia, there are sexual forms and there are asexual forms. And even in genus Drosophila, there is one asexual species. So mammals are an exception. It seems that mammals cannot do away with sex because of genomic imprinting and other purely developmental things. But Drosophila can abandon sex if they want. So if you find a sexual species with big U well below one, this mutational hypothesis of sex is certainly indubitable. That's absolutely possible. So the question of invention of sex and question of the maintenance of sex, they may be different, but invention of sex was 2 billion years ago. So let's start from a simpler question of why sex is maintained now. And this question makes sense because we do know that a lot of organisms can abandon sexual reproduction. There is this Daphne Pollux, I believe, which in America is sexual and in Canada it is asexual. Every time it crosses Canadian border, it stops doing sex. No, literally, there are a lot of clones. So this is something which can evolve right now. So this question makes sense. So Kiesler said that. Kiesler said that Mukai was wrong at the very core of his experiment, and then there was a big tempest in the teapot. All 10 people in the world who cares about this business became very furious and started saying different things. And I was at Cornell at that time and had an access to flies. So we made an experiment slightly modifying Mukai's design. So our goal was less ambitious. We didn't even seriously try to measure the increase in the variance. We only tried to measure the decline in the mean. And because what is the point in measuring the variance if you are not certain even about the mean? So
can I ask? I'm just puzzled. How did he shut down selection by giving medical care?
No, medical care is also important. But you have a male. You have a Drosophila male, and it has a second chromosome, one marked with phenotype curly, and having a lot of inversions which prevents this thing from recombining with normal chromosome. Another chromosome normal. Then this is a male. You cross him with a normal female, and you in the offspring you get you collect only males which have. Okay, now I'm confused. No, I think that females were also marked. Yeah, females were also marked with another balancer, which was plum, something like this. So in the offspring, you also collect a male, for which you want to make sure that it has this chromosome. So you take a male which is plum, wild type. I don't remember exactly, but it was something like this. So then you have this. Yeah, plum is eye color, and plum is eye color, and curly is curled wings. So when you see this male, you know that it got this wild chromosome from this male, and then you cross him, presumably with a female which is curly wild type. So you keep transferring this chromosome too from generation to generation without recombination, and as long as you keep them under optimal conditions without selection. Of course, you have some residual selection; some eggs will die. But presumably only a small fraction of it. So we made several modifications. In particular, we didn't use any balancers. We only used equal family sizes. So in each vial, we put one female and one male, and allow the female to lay a small number of eggs so they don't, the SIBs don't compete with each other. And then we randomly picked one daughter and one son from each vial, we mix them, and we started a new generation. This is called middle-class neighborhood design, because that's exactly like humans breed in middle-class neighborhood. So this way we avoided this balancer business, and mutations accumulated in the whole diploid genome instead of one chromosome. That's one thing, and another thing, we tried like crazy to have a good control. So our most flashy thing was cryopreservation. A guy who works at Cornell, Peter Steponkos, developed a technique for cryopreserving Drosophila embryos. So you put them in liquid nitrogen, which is easy, but then you recover them alive. So while these things were struggling in our middle-class neighborhood, the control was just sitting in liquid nitrogen, presumably doing nothing. And we made a special investigation to show that this cryopreservation procedure is not mutagenic, so it was a lot of experimental fun. Nobody could repeat our data because we did this cryopreservation in Steponkos' lab, and outside his lab nobody can do this cryopreservation, but that's their problem.
What's the hard thing about it? Try it.
Well, I can kind of make a performance how you do this. You have a Drosophila eggs. You put them in heptane for 5 seconds, in ethylene glycol 35% solution for 35 seconds. First of all, you bleach them. Then you put them on small, you know, these pads for electron microscopy. Then you make liquid nitrogen ice and you dump them into them. And then you have to remove them and see then they crawl and start feeding. And if you succeed once, this would be impressive. It's very bad. Then we measured mutation rate, and the mutation rate was not affected by this procedure. So this was our frozen control. We also had what we called cold control flies, which were kept under 16 centigrade, so the generation time, instead of being 11 days in experiment, it was 25 days. And we also resampled the same natural population next year, so it was our wild control. They all gave exactly the same results. So our results were in perfect agreement with Mukai. Decline of fitness 2% per generation in this middle-class neighborhood experiment. So after 30 generations, they were in real lousy shape.
How many chemicals were in the
100.
Big enough, because small populations are known to degenerate.
Well, sure, but the question is why. In Britain, which accumulated here, was pretty small because we had equal family size, so the effective size of the population was 2 times larger than the actual size. So the actual size was 200 individuals, the effective size was 400 individuals, and in the course of 30... Yes, the effective size, if you have equal family size, the effective size is 2 times larger than the actual size. Kuro Kimura, Table 2, Chapter 3.
So is this why we need the rich and the poor?
I don't need the rich and the poor.
No.
I want to be rich and don't care about anything else.
I mean, when we are saying you wouldn't want to be in middle class neighborhood.
Okay. Wait a second. So we got this decline, and then, of course, Keatley said that we are stupid, that cryopreservation is immoral, and that all this is nonsense. And he confronted us with his own results. And he worked on C. elegans and didn't observe any decline of fitness. So the bottom line is that I'm not... Yeah, and this is not the whole story. There is a guy in Australia named Dick Frankham who actually did exactly the same experiment before we did our middle class neighborhood experiment and came up with exactly the same results. When we were finishing the thing, I came across his talk in which he observed exactly the same decline. And I jumped on him begging that he publish it. It was only 4 years ago, and 2 weeks ago he sent me a manuscript. So his results will be published. And Dick said that the decline is real, but it is not because of deleterious mutations. So Mukai and we say that the decline is real because of mutations. Keesley says that there is no decline, and Frankham has that the decline is real, but it has nothing to do with bad mutations. He believes that, I think that what he's saying is completely bizarre. He says that they have adaptation to good conditions, which due to negative pleiotropy impairs their performance under bad conditions. And I believe that just the Kuro index is too low and you cannot have any opportunity for selection here. Because we, in some sense, we did a lot of extra work. We measured the mortality, and the mortality was pretty low. And without mortality, well, there was some rate of infecundity for about 5% of our families didn't produce any offspring, and also about 15% of eggs didn't produce adults. Okay, I don't want to go into all the details, it's messy Drosophila genetics, but the bottom line is that I am not going to do this kind of experiments anymore. And I believe, I am afraid that this kind of experiments will not settle the question of genomic deleterious mutation rate to everybody's satisfaction, unfortunately. It looks very promising. You shut down selection, you see how rapidly fitness declines, but these experiments are really difficult, and then different people get different results. There are people in Spain who don't observe this decline. So basically, whatever you want to get, you get it, and at some point it becomes stupid. So this is mutation accumulation approach, and I still believe that Mukai is right, but I am afraid that there is no way to prove it to everybody's satisfaction. Then what else can you do? Let's write the following equation. G is a haploid genome size in nucleotides. Mu is per nucleotide mutation rate. So this term together gives you total number of mutations per zygote. And F is a fraction of a DNA which is controlled by selection, as opposed to being neutral. Very profound equation. So measuring genome size in nucleotides is not difficult. And if we can measure what fraction of the genome is controlled by selection and then measure polynucleotide mutation rate, we are in very good shape. And I think that we have a genuine progress in understanding what fraction of the genome is controlled by selection. So the story is this. Nobody would doubt that most of protein coding DNA is controlled by selection, at least nucleotides which are non-synonymous. To what extent synonymous substitutions are neutral, nearly neutral, probably the answer may be different for different organisms, but for amino acid coding positions, most of amino acid substitutions which arise are not accepted by evolving populations. So the first question is, what fraction of the genome is coding? And we, thanks to genomics, we know the answer. It's 30% for quote-unquote invertebrates with small genomes, and also for plants with small genomes like Arabidopsis. So let's see, Drosophila melanogaster and C. elegans and Arabidopsis celeni is the same thing. For mammals, we don't know the answer, but now it seems that this is only 2%. Some time ago, I would say 5%. Now it seems that this is even less. So the latest estimate, which I still find hard to accept, is 35,000 genes per mammalian genome. The average length of a gene is 1.5 kb, I mean, of total length of coding exons. So it gives you 50 million. Out of 3 billion, it's only, say, let's say 2%. So we can be sure that at least, say, 20% of Drosophila genome is controlled by selection. For humans, it can be as low as about 2%. So how do you go about measuring this fraction more precisely? One approach is what people call comparative genomics. Sounds very frightening, and the idea is very simple, though. You take a pair of species which had enough time to diverge beyond recognition, then you compare them, and whatever, and you always observe something like this. There are regions which we call bubbles, where there is no meaningful alignment. And then there are regions which can be called hits, where the things are highly similar. And if you see these big bubbles, you can argue that these two species have enough time to become completely dissimilar without selection. And then, assuming a simple model first introduced by Kimura, when we say that a nucleotide is either completely neutral or completely forbidden from evolving, you can estimate selective constraint as a fraction of these nucleotides which are forbidden to evolve. So we did it for comparing to, well, C. elegans and its close relative, Cynorhabditis brixa, and our estimate was, it's probably the same for Drosophila. Let's pretend that C. elegans and Drosophila is the same thing. So our estimate was 20%. And now we did it. It will be published in Trends in Genetics in July for human and mouse intergenic DNA. And our estimate is 10%. And interestingly, there are old data on DNA-DNA hybridization by Britton Davidson and people like this, who measured DNA-DNA hybridization between human and rat. And they observed that 15% of DNA hybridizes, which means has significant similarity. And it now seems almost certain that without some kind of selective constraint, two sequences, one human and another rodent, would be so dissimilar that they wouldn't hybridize, that's for sure, and probably they wouldn't be similar over random level at all. So I believe that these things are correct. I'm sure that they're correct to the order of magnitude, which is interesting for its own right, because it gives you some answer about neutrality and Darwinism. So to speak, Kimura's domain is 90% of human DNA, and Darwin's domain is 10% of human DNA. This 10% is probably an underestimation, because you can have nearly neutral something, so it's not completely neutral, but it's neutral enough, so selection is not very efficient. And then it will be classified as neutral according to these approaches.
Do you have any guess as to what percent of the DNA is different between human and rat because of significant differences between human and rat?
Of course not. And everything which is responsible for differences between human and rat also will go into this neutral domain. So this 10% is obviously an underestimation, but I believe that it gives you the correct. I believe that this gives you the correct order of magnitude.
Right. So you think it's less than 5%?
What is less than?
The significant nucleotide differences that make a human.
It may be another 10%. So yeah. 10 plus 10 gives you 20, which is still 10 on the logarithmic scale. Who cares? So I think that it's fair to say that for mammals with their huge genomes, we have to multiply total genomic mutation rate by 0.1 in order to get deleterious genomic mutation rate. And for Drosophila, it's probably the coefficient is a little bit higher. But we are certainly not talking about 1%, or we're not certainly talking about 100%. So we have surprisingly good success. Well, as usual, there are people who criticize it. We had to fight with the reviewers who said that there was not enough time for saturation between human and mouse. I don't know, but most of human and murine DNA is not alignable. That's all I can say. So I believe that this is correct up to the order of magnitude. So genome size we know. What is pronucleotide mutation rate? How much more time are you willing to tolerate me? Should I wrap it up? Give me some figure.
What do you need?
What do you need?
I need to go and eat dinner, so tell me.
What's a reasonable?
10 minutes?
10, 15 minutes is
fine. Okay. So for per nucleotide mutation rate, let's make this long story very short. There are two ways of measuring this. One way is through evolution. As we heard this morning, if you have a really neutral sequence, it evolves with the rate which is equal to mutation rate. That's what Jim Crow calls fundamental theorem of neutral evolution. And some people have very kind of risky attitude. They declare everything neutral, including synonymous positions, which we know are not neutral. But if you take some lousy process pseudogene in primates, I think it's fair to believe that this thing is really neutral. So Michael Nachman took orthologous pseudogenes from humans and chimps, hoping that we more or less know when they had their last common ancestor, and so how many generations came from the common ancestor. You also need to make adjustments for the variability within the ancestral population due to lineage sorting. Anyway, after doing all this believable mathematics, he came up with for nucleotide mutation rate equal to 2 times 10 to the minus 8. Unfortunately, even in this exceptionally good case, the uncertainty is within the factor of 3 or 5, if you want. Because we don't... How long is the chimp generation in nature? We have no clue. How big was the ancestral population? We have no clue. So all these things together give you a lot of stuff. And also, that's something which I probably will not have time to discuss, but pronucleotide mutation rate, of course, is a fiction. Because you can have different events and you can have different nucleotides. There are nucleotides which are methylated in the genome, and they mutate with a rate which is elevated easily by one order of magnitude, and some hotspots have mutation rate elevated by 3 or 4 orders of magnitude. Then you can have events of different types, and they all have different rates. So this pronucleotide mutation rate is like an average temperature in the hospital, but still it gives you some very rough idea. So if we believe in this, let's calculate the total mutation rate. We get 6 billion.
Those are all point mutations.
Yes. In humans, the vast majority of mutations are point mutations. Transposable elements are extremely rare. That's what we know. Because when you take cases of Mendelian genetic diseases, 99% of mutations will be substitutions of very short deletions or insertions.
But you get lots of variability in the number of repeats in satellites.
Yeah, satellites. Satellites are horrible. You can have per one satellite a mutation rate of the order of 10%. That's a very good point, because we have specially mutable crazy rich pieces of DNA which are called satellites, and together they can easily account for huge number of mutations. We believe that they are neutral, and the four we can ignore them, but whether they're really neutral, we don't know. So that's a good point. Let's forget about satellites. Since I'm going to argue that mutation rate is high, I have a right to forget about things which can help me. So if I am correct with the multiplication, the answer is 100, right? It must be 100. So the total number of de novo mutations for a human zygote is 100. And I think that now this is kind of more or less universally accepted. Incidentally, I did a historical investigation. The first time this 100 appears was in a review in the periodic volume called Advances in Genetics by Vogel and I even forget the second author name, published in 1975, a review of human mutation. But textbooks for the next 25 years repeated the standard lie that maybe one newborn in 10 carries a de novo mutation, which is true just by three orders of magnitude. So every newborn carries 100 de novo mutations. And among these 100 mutations, I believe at least 10 are deleterious. So for Homo sapiens, my estimate of big U is 10, and I believe that this is correct by the order of magnitude. Not everybody would agree with this, but I don't find arguments against it very interesting.
I have a conceptual problem. Mm-hmm. So in this formula, you are U. The measurement entry from U is strictly neutral, or it's obtained from neutral.
Mm-hmm.
You think they are neutral.
Yes.
And F is the fraction of the genome subject to.
Yes, we assume that mutation rate doesn't depend if you are subject to selection or not. So whether it's a gene or pseudogene, it mutates with the same rate, which might be not the case, but we have absolutely no data for this. It would be strange.
Yeah, but then even in, do you think that in that 10% subject to selection, there you count then everyone as deleterious? I mean, couldn't there be also neutral ones?
Yes. No, I'm not saying that you have a fraction where everybody is deleterious. You count the 10% is a fraction of of selectively important nucleotides, and they don't not necessarily go well just in strict succession.
So maybe what the number is safe.
But you got the S estimate for F from sort of.
20% 20% of human genome is covered by these hits, is alignable with mouse. And we estimate that about half of nucleotides within these hits are really constrained by selection. So you you multiply 20 by half and you get 10%. So that's a head count of bad of important nucleotides.
And you're saying any mutation that we suppose any hitting in those conserved spots.
Not every, but 50%. Mm-hmm. So I think we did this in a reasonable way. I would be surprised. I would be surprised. No, I'm very happy to indicate weak points in this business. And, okay.
These are mutations in the vigor. Probably in the born children they are much lower.
No.
Most of these guys probably.
No. No. If you have 100 independent events, the standard deviation will be 10. So the probability that a newborn doesn't have any new mutation is e up to minus 100.
What I'm trying to say is that maybe is that the way I interpret your number of 10 is that out of 10 times that the fermenter is penetrated over,
it's about only one time that the division passes the third generation.
No, 10 de novo mutations doesn't mean this. If you, it's 10, the probability that you don't get anything is e up to the minus 10, which is an incredibly small number. And also, most of these mutations are mild. We do know exist that there is a pretty high prenatal mortality in humans, about 35%. But I doubt it's because of this kind of mutations. It's chromosome aberration, so it's a separate big subject. The only thing, there are really two things which is left, which I want. To say before I finish. First of all, this number can be estimated in at least one other totally different way. Suppose that you have data on genetic nature of some Mendelian disease, like hemophilia B. So for this disease, you know per locus mutation rate. Sometimes you know it pretty well. Then you have big database on independent patients, and for each patient you know what was the nature of mutation which caused the disease, and then you know the DNA sequence, so you can calculate the target size. For example, you can say that within this gene there are 100 nucleotides such that replacing C with T at these nucleotides will create an in-frame stop. And using this information, it's very easy to come up with another totally independent estimate of pronucleotide mutation rate. And I'm just finishing this paper on this, which was an absolute hell, because I studied 20 different loci and have to read about 1,000 papers in like Norwegian Journal of Pediatrics and CERN. I learned a lot about horrible genetic diseases, and the answer is going to be reasonably close to this. Maybe a little bit lower, maybe it will be 1 times 10 up to the minus 8. But it's remarkable that two entirely different approaches give you more or less the same thing. So for humans, I believe that this is correct up to the order of magnitude, although not everybody agrees with this, but here I'm willing just to wait and see. For Drosophila, genome size is much smaller. Haploid genome is only 300 million. And pronucleotide mutation rate in Drosophila is simply unknown. So it seems that it might be a little bit lower than in humans. So if it's the smallest, if it's more or less the same thing, then the total number of bad mutations for Drosophila is 3, and the total number of all mutations for Drosophila is 3, and the number of bad mutations is of the order of 1. So if in Drosophila pronucleotide mutation rate, whatever it means, if is of the order of 10 up to the minus 8, then big U is of the order of 1. If it's of the order of 10 up to the minus 9, then big U is significantly below 1. And that's where all the action happens now. I believe it's 10 up to the minus 8, although I'm not really convinced. And Kiesley believed that it's 10 up to the minus 9, so big U is small enough and he's happy. And who is right, we don't know. And there are several clever experimental designs which can be used to measure it. But I'm afraid that it will all be eventually done by brute force of sequencing. So you take father fly, you take mother fly, you take baby fly, you sequence the whole goddamn things from the beginning to the end, and then you count mutations. These days we cannot do this because... Exactly, error rate. That's, if you remember Feynman's book, how he investigated this Challenger disaster, and he asked this NASA big bosses what is the error rate in these launches, and nobody could give him any answer. Somebody said that it's 100% certain that everything will go successfully. I had exactly the same experience asking this sequencing people what is the error rate of sequencing. Nobody could give me an answer. So this is not doable today, but there are some methods of detecting mutations, so I think in 10 years this will be doable. So I'm afraid that this lousy sequencing again will spoil a good biological question and produce a simple answer. But right now we simply don't know. I also wanted to tell you stories about the equilibrium presence of deleterious mutations. But probably we don't have time for this.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe we copy the official part.
Yeah, there are some reprints, if you want reprints. There are two white paper reprints, which is hardcore Drosophila genetics, and which you probably don't want, but if you take them, this would be great, because I don't want to carry them back. And that's a review, general review, which might be interesting. Okay.